Evening. Well, poor Subhuti just keeps trying and trying, and we keep trying and trying with him, so poor us too. This is chapter 8. Who would like to read this? Jeffrey, would you read it?
Oh, I'm glad to. 8. The Buddha said, Subhuti, what do you think? If some noble son or daughter build the building worlds of this universe with the 7 jewels and gave them as a gift to the Tathagatas, the Arhats, the fully enlightened ones, would the body of merit produced as a result by this noble son or daughter be great? Subhuti answered, great indeed, Bhagavan. The body of merit produced as a result by that noble son or daughter would be great, Sagata. And how so? Bhagavan, whatever is said by the Tathagata to be a body of merit is said by the Tathagata to be no body. Thus does the Tathagata speak of a body of merit as a body of merit. The Buddha said, Subhuti, if instead of filling the billion worlds of this universe with the 7 jewels and giving them as a gift to the Tathagatas, the Arhats, the fully enlightened ones, this noble son or daughter grasped but 1 4-line gatha of this Dharma teaching and made it known and explained it in details to others, the body of merit produced as a result would be immeasurably, infinitely greater. And how so? Subhuti, from this is born the unexcelled perfect enlightenment of Tathagatas, Arhats, and fully enlightened ones. From this are born Buddhas and Bhagavans. And how so? Buddha Dharmas, Subhuti. Buddha Dharmas are spoken of by the Tathagata as no Buddha Dharmas. Thus they are called Buddha Dharmas.
Nobody quite knows what is meant by the 4 lines, the gatha of 4 lines. But some think, and I always think it just because it seems reasonable to me, that the last, at the very end, there is a gatha, a 4-line gatha. On chapter 32, explaining by not explaining. And it's a famous one that many, many people know Buddhism by. As a lamp, a cataract, a star in space, an illusion, a dewdrop, a bubble, a dream, a cloud, a flash of lightning. View all created things like this. So that's just, that isn't the very last one, but it's this almost. I guess it is. In any case, that's essentially what Buddha is trying to teach Shariputra, the instant coming and going of all things, the complete undependability of all things, and that nothing can be pinned down. the body of merit is one of the things that is a very, very old idea, and it's got lots of levels to it. The earning of merit by doing good is, I think, goes back to the cavemen and maybe before. It's logical. We see the benefit of it. And so to consider that we could decide to live in terms of gaining merit in our world with each other, it makes sense. And so it began to develop this idea into a way of talking about the Tathagata, of what Tathagata is. And body of merit is one way of talking about Buddha. It's an incomplete way. As Nirmanakaya, the body of Buddha as the appearance of Buddha in the world, also is, in the end, not real. So they say, in explaining the Tathagata, they said these three aspects all come together as one Dharmakaya, the great unspeakable Buddha life of all the universes in all the universes. So the Dharmakaya is the Buddha's true body, which means everything that we see in some sense is Buddha, and that we all participate in this dynamic that we call Buddha, and that that's made up of the merit that accumulates as we do good things. And as Buddha is saying, you can do all these good things, especially around jewels and giving lots of stuff. But that actually the greatest worth is the giving of a few words. That just speaking a few honest words is worth more than all the jewels. And that there's more merit in it because there's more truth. As they say, the jewels come and go. We can win the lottery and make a lot of money and get all excited about it. And then the story is, in so many of those cases, that people spend all the money and then they're right back where they started from, or worse. Often having lost it all or blown it all. So if we think in terms of how a life is lived, depending on jewels and fancy stuff, Cadillac cars, hasn't nearly the worth as depending on a few true words. The very first meditation class I ever took was at Foothill College. And there was a gentleman, very upright and sort of looked like a Buddha himself. And his very first part of the presentation was all the things that we could get if we learned to meditate. And he promised us a Cadillac car, among many other things. And I thought, I don't think I'm coming back here. But that's one level of it, of course. That's one level that we approach our life with, what comes from it. And our culture is based on getting and spending. getting and spending, we lay waste our powers. So Buddha is pointing to something more subtle. So the Nirmanakaya body of Buddha is what they call the apparition body, the body that appears in order to teach. And that's actually becoming the essence of this. It's not his true body, it's the fruit of a bodhisattva's practice. The bodhisattva practicing the paramitas, the first of which is giving, the whole thing becomes an outpouring of practice, a kind of devotional practice in a very practical way. And from that becomes a way of speaking about practice, speaking about how to live this life. The word Tathagata refers to the original body of all beings, or your face before your parents were born. It's one of those famous metaphors for this that you can't really say. It's the whole body, the original body of all beings. The Buddha wants us, this is Chang Wei Nung who is saying this, the Buddha wants us to recognize the impermanent owner of this impermanent body. Only then can we not be affected by appearances. And that's another way of thinking about our practice. That much of the teaching is about how not to judge what comes before us, not to leap to conclusions about what we see and hear, but allow the whole thing to come and meet us and allow ourselves to be met. And knowing it's impermanent certainly helps. It's a huge help. It's helpful in dire circumstances for sure, but it's also helpful in happy circumstances, because we can get so attached to our happiness that we forget and get terribly disappointed when it disappears. So having a more equanimous way of seeing, understanding how a life appears in us, so that we don't lose our sensibility, that we know it's not going to stay. I just did a poetry workshop, writing workshop, she called it, up in Inverness, beautiful up in Tomales Bay. It was all wildflowers everywhere. I've never seen so much cow parsley ever. And the subject was hope, which is my least favorite subject, because it sets us up for disappointment. It creates a false sense that that we have some control, or that we can make something happen if we wish for it hard enough, or hope for it hard enough, or pray for it hard enough, that it will all come to pass. And of course, the truth is there's so many causes and conditions that go into every circumstance that we really have very little to say about what happens. So I had a good time with it. We went back and forth from one side to the other. There's one side of hoping and then the other side of just accepting whatever happens. And so we wrote on both sides of it, and that was very helpful. I had a good time with it. Took a long walk down at McClure's Beach, going down to the water, and wildflowers all over the hills on either side. I started naming all the flowers, and I found 16 that I knew by name. I was so happy. It was just like they were all just coming up out of the ground. It was so beautiful. So Chung Li is another one of the commentators in here, said that the Buddha's three bodies are like a reflection on sunlit water. This is a different metaphor from the one I told you last week. Three bodies are like a reflection on sunlit water. The incarnated body is the reflection. The reward body is the sunlight. The reward or the merit, the body of merit, is the sunlight. And the real body is the water. The Buddha tells Subhuti that if he wants to see the water, he needs to look past the reflection and the sunlight. So I will hand this out so you can have it, and I'll hand this out also. So Subhuti is still hanging on to emptiness here. And Buddha is trying to nudge him out of it. Xuan Chung said, though the merit that results from an offering of all the seven precious things in a billion worlds is great, once it is gone, the suffering of life and death resume. Though a four-line gatha of this sutra is small, it leads directly to enlightenment. And that, I think, is an important point, that we're so dazzled by what's large and what's many. And often the truth and our salvation is all lying in something very small and simple. So Red Pond says, the difference between the arhat and bodhisattva paths is arhats are able to attain liberation from suffering and rebirth, but as long as they remain limited by the emptiness and detachment of their practice, they can be of no help to others. And often I meet people who want to discuss this. How to live as a Buddhist is to step far enough back that we ourselves are not affected by what happens, and that we can take a sort of God's eye view. But that's the arhat view, of isolating oneself from what's happening and refusing to engage, getting oneself all fixed up and in order, but leaving everybody else hungry and wanting. So Red Pine says, here the Buddha contrasts these two spiritual paths in order to reveal the true nature of this teaching. So the arhat would pour all the jewels in, but the bodhisattva would would teach. Red Pine said, every teaching focuses on this to the exclusion of that, upholds one thing and ignores or denies something else. The teaching of Prajna focuses on nothing, upholds nothing. It is no teaching. Only such a teaching as this can clear away all obstacles to liberation, which is the Bodhisattva's goal. So let's pass these out. They're two pages. Thank you. They're not attached. They're just floating around. Are there questions? Comments? Sally?
I have a comment about hope. And you're despairing about people thinking that hope is something that is under our control. I mean, we can make things happen.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm wondering if we can just be hopeful, and when good things do happen, we can enjoy them.
Well, we can. It just adds a little more, it's extra. You know, if we're trying to actually see clearly, then hope gets very much in the way. But it is a pleasure. Often it's a pleasure if we're looking forward to going to ride on the roller coaster or something. You know, oh goody, you know, I hope we get there. But it often is a state of worry. There was a woman who I'm not supposed to talk about the people, but there was a good example of that, that we come into our life with, because the people that we come from also have this kind of endless worry that we inherit. It goes back all the way to Adam and Eve, I think. And that's extra. It gets in the way of our seeing what's actually going on.
So but, is that then the opposite of hope, the endless worry? That both of which get in the way?
Yeah. Yeah, that's the other side. Yeah. Donnellan?
Yeah, hope is interesting. Promise. Around acceptance and hope. And many times I've thought of why I need to accept that my husband is chronically ill, but I hope that it gets well. But, you know, hoping it gets well is wishing it another way. But I feel like if I accept it, then it's, you know, that there's not room for change or to be different. And I've gone back, and I think I've talked about it before, but it's a very interesting thing, because when we hope is, the way that I hope is I want something to be different than what it really is. So then I think of aspiration or merit.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, feels a little more tangible. It's a very interesting topic. I'm surprised you still went.
Yeah. It was fine.
What really struck me in this chapter this time was it wasn't understanding the four Lingotta, it was sharing.
Mm-hmm. Teaching and learning.
Really, for me, I guess that thinking it's it's two things. One, it shows an understanding, and then it shows not hoarding or keeping it hot, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Giving it away.
Yeah. That's yeah. Thank you. That's right. There's a kind of pain that comes with that kind of situation, the one that you have to endure, that's built into it, really. As long as you have some wish for it to be different, it's going to hurt. And that, you know, there's nothing to say that we aren't supposed to hurt, because we do hurt when a situation becomes, we begin to see how unfixable something can be. But the more we're able to accept it, I think the more freeing, the mind becomes more free. Because otherwise it's still holding on so hard. Yeah. We had to write an occasion where we had a false hope and were disappointed. And that was really interesting, just to look back and think about, you know, I thought of one that was very painful, because I really, really wanted it to be a certain way. And it took me a long time to see it. And then when I did, oh my. But it was a relief also to accept it and then find a way to deal with it. Because otherwise we're helpless. We can't deal with it either.
And everything does change.
Yes, it does. And we don't know.
If his health got better, woohoo, I bet you I could adjust.
I bet you could.
Yeah, I'm holding on to that. I'm starting to feel that.
Yeah.
It's very...
Yeah. Me too.
Just listening to... I was thinking about him. Putting it all together, the juxtaposition of accepting things, but then also not holding on too tight to the way things are.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you accept it too much, then maybe there's no room for change, or when change happens, that can be painful too.
Yes.
Like a, I don't even know, that's the dance.
Well, it is. Be ready to be surprised at any moment. Yes. But accepting whatever you've got and dealing with it as best you can.
Because we don't know.
Yes. Yes.
You don't really accept something. There's nothing.
Right. There's nothing.
There you go.
Yep.
Yeah. A flexibility. I don't know how to say it, but a flexibility about what you have.
Mm-hmm.
We don't really know what we have, because you started by saying that without having judgment about what we see, so we don't really know.
Yes. We tend to make a story about it, though, and fit it into whatever we think our story is, and that gets it farther away from what it is, often, because we begin to tweak it and twirl it and make it into something that is palatable to us, even though that may not be even be what it is. Sally?
I was thinking about providing hospice care for someone, and how if your expectations kind of diminish, diminish is not the right word, but you know, your world kind of becomes smaller, but you can still find pleasure in things as your expectations do become smaller.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's kind of like when you're sick and you get well, you really appreciate the fact that you can breathe.
Yes. Yes, it is.
You're healthy, you don't necessarily appreciate that. Mm. So just feeling how wonderfully soft the sheets are, or the, if you're sitting in front of the window, how lovely the breeze feels on your face can bring so much pleasure. And these are things that you don't necessarily appreciate when you're just so busy in your life and your mind, you know, going about your world and day and world with much bigger expectations. But it can be so freeing and lovely.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I know what you're saying. It's
well, it's 8:00.